One of the things that brings you to BAI is the colloquium that's coming up December 10th. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is being sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Opera, and it's also the Cell Theater, which is at 338 West 23rd Street. And it's the evening of December 10th. We're planning a colloquium on the subject of the book, The New Music Theater. And we have a number of interesting people that are going to participate in that colloquium. Rindy Eckert, who is a fascinating performer and composer himself. The conductor, Stephen Osgood. Diane Wandesford, who is the director of the Music Theater Group. Greta Holby, the stage director. She was the founder of American Opera Projects and also directed the wall-to-wall opera production of The Last Words of Dutch Schultz. So, and maybe Meredith Monk. I haven't been able to pin Meredith down yet. She has some conflict, but she's going to try to make it. So we'll see.
Yes.
But anyway, that's the panel. And wow. Tomas and myself will be there discussing the book and the subject itself of the book, the New Music Theater, where it's come from, where it's going, and so forth. So the public is invited. It's free.
Can you give the location again?
Okay. It's The Cell Theater. It's 338 West 23rd Street. And it's 8 p.m. on the evening of December 10th.
Can I give out the website?
Sure.
For the Center for Contemporary Opera can be found at www.conopera.org. One word, conopera.org. Steve recently conducted Xenakis' only opera, Orestes, the Miller Theater.
Whew. Right.
Bang up job.
Yeah.
No pun intended. Great work.
Yeah.
Now, You pass some music my way.
We were talking about early music voices and the sort of sound of clear, what sometimes called, although some people object to the term, white voices.
White being free of vibrato
being
and coloring.
Basically, yeah, exactly. And I recently had a commission from the Western Wind Vocal Ensemble, which is one of the great vocal ensembles of New York, and which, of course, does a great deal of early music, although they have always had, from the start, a wide range, doing contemporary music, early American music, and so on and so forth. At any rate, one of their star pieces that they've done over the years is a madrigal comedy dating from the early years of the 17th century by a composer named Adriano Banchieri. The title of the piece is La Barca di Venezia per Padova, the ferry boat from Venice to Padua. It takes place on the boat. It's a very amusing piece with various characters speaking in various dialects and so on and so forth. And this piece, which is like half an evening, they decided that they wanted to have a companion piece. And that was the idea of the commission, to do a modern madrigal comedy, to go with the 1600 magical comedy. At first, we were going to do it on a subway train from Manhattan to Queens, but for various reasons, the piece ended up in a New York bar during a big thunderstorm when all the lights go out. So the whole piece is played by candlelight. A bunch of different people who normally would never be in the same place at the same time wander in to get shelter, and they're all stuck in the bar during the storm and blackout. And in true Renaissance fashion, each of them tells their story. They talk to strangers that they've never met before, and suddenly they're all telling their very personal stories. I should say that my collaborator and the wonderful librettist of this piece, as with Dutch Schultz, is also Valeria Vasilevsky. And the two sections that I was thinking about playing are, one is called Not Porcelain Dolls, and it's a love story of a certain kind, and as most of the pieces in this now are, and the other is called Toast Love or Ghost Love, Ghost Love, Toast Love, and both of these are very personal stories that people tell. I think the text is pretty clear in the performance, so maybe we'll just play those two pieces.
And who are the performers again?
Okay, this is the Western Wind the Western Wind Vocal Ensemble. And the form of the entire piece is a madrigal comedy, which means that each number there is a lead singer who tells the story, but all the other singers participate in the number as they would in a madrigal.
You're listening to Through the Opera Glass here on WBAI New York, and we're listening and talking with Eric Salzman, co-author of The New Music Theater by Oxford University Press, and now for his music.
Yeah, well, that was obviously Ghost Love or Toast Love. And the song, actually, of someone who's just lost his partner to AIDS. And it's part of the Madrigal Comedy, which we call, I didn't give the title before, so I got to give the whole title. It's called Jukebox in the Tavern of Love. And it's by Valeria Vasilevsky, the text, and I wrote the music, Eric Salzman. And this piece was done by the Western Wind. It's going to be brought back this spring at the Flea Theater in downtown New York. And also, we're working on a CD and also a DVD. So we should have it in a couple of different forms. Also, I mentioned a piece called Not Porcelain Dolls, which we didn't play. Maybe it's worth, it's short, and maybe it's worth playing that piece because it's being sung by a performer who's from the Western Wind, who really has an early music voice, and you hear it, the quality of that voice, very clearly because she has a big solo and it's all laid out. Anyway, so let's listen to that.
It was long ago, my hair was red, my skin as white as my hair is now. Then a secret life I led. Now it may seem silly, if so, be kind, don't laugh.
Girl, I followed the boy's path. I told
So that was Not Porcelain Dolls, one of the sections from the magical comedy that I wrote for The Western Wind called Jukebox in the Tavern of Love.
And who were the singers? Soloists aren't on the disc.
No. These are all the singers from The Western Wind. It's a great bunch of singers. What I was going to say was that this whole business about singing styles and ranges, like, is a very big part, I think, of the whole music theater movement. And you were asking me actually before off mic about Roy Hart,
right? But before we go to Roy Hart, this is going to be performed live, so if people want to hear it, when will that be?
The Jukebox in the Tavern of Love has been done a couple of times by the Western Wind. The plan right now is for it to be brought back at the Flea Theater in downtown New York this coming spring. I think it would be end of May, beginning of June is when it's being planned for. And it will be a fully staged performance of it by the Western Wind, directed by Valeria Vasilevsky, who wrote the text. Also, I'm hoping by then we will have both a CD and a DVD of the piece as well. So it'll be available in a couple of different forms.
In your collaborations, what comes first, the text or the music?
Mostly the text, pretty much always the text. I am a composer who gets inspired by words and by text. Sometimes not conventionally. Some of the texts that I use are not necessarily traditional texts, but text does definitely give a big push. Text, not just only the words that you're setting, but also the context, the characters, the shape of the piece that you're working on, the dramatic movement, where you're going, where you're coming from, where you're going with the piece. All those have a big influence on me.
And have you ever written your own text?
Yeah, I have. In the collaborations with Michael Saul, I worked a lot on text. Most of the pieces, I did six pieces with Michael. Five of them, we did words and music together. In the sixth piece called Boxes, I did the text and Michael did the music. But in the first five, we collaborated. I think I have some example of that with me. Probably the piece that was done the most was a one actor called Civilization and Its Discontents, which takes place in a singles bar. We could play the opening section of that.
Okay. While you're searching for it, I noticed that their vibrato less music, their singing, reminds me of Eastern European folk singing, the Bulgarian voices that were so popular about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
The very pure tone. And if she were to sing this piece with the vibrato, we wouldn't understand the words.
Well, that's an issue, and in a lot of cases, understanding the words is an important part of the experience. So,
now, what track should I play?
I think you should just play the opening.
Okay,
And then we'll just fade it out. Okay.
Okay.
The first voice you hear is that of Carlos Arachnid, who is our genial host at Club Bidoui, and invites us to come in and join the people at this singles bar. And then we'll hear the voices at the singles bar. And
that sounds very much like a cabaret setup where you have a narrator who acts as an MC who tells you the persona. How about setting up Civilization and Its Discontents?
Okay, well, the scene is a singles bar. Carlos Arachnid.
As in Spider?
As in Spider, okay. Yeah. He's weaving his web to entrap us. And he invites us to come in by singing a little nursery rhyme. And then we meet the characters of this little mini drama, who are Derek Dude and his girlfriend, Jill Goodhart. And anyway, he introduces them to us. We hear all the people singing, "If it feels good, do it." And then we hear all the catchphrases, especially of the period of that time when this piece was written. And it just creates the kind of the atmosphere of the bar. And anyway, this is a piece that I wrote with Michael Saul, words and music. And it's called Civilization and Its Discontents. Yes, it comes. The title comes from Freud. And here's the opening of the piece.
Boys and girls come out to play. The moon doth shine as bright as day. Leave your supper and leave your sleep and join your little playfellows out in the street. Come with a whoop, come with a call, come with goodwill or not at all.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. My name is Carlos Arachnid. I am your host this evening at Club Bidoe. Come meet your friends and other strangers. Come meet young Jeremy Jive. Come meet Jill Goodhart and her boyfriend, Derek Dude. Come in and stay a while. Hey, smile, dance. Check your paranoia at the door. Your thoughts are safely in your head. Come out on the floor instead.
If it feels good, do it. Do you hear it? Do you see it? Do you feel it? Do you want it?
We had to do a little on-the-fly editing to keep us legal. Eric, what year was this composed?
That's a good question. This was written originally in the 70s. Another version, maybe a revision, was done in the 80s. So it goes back to that time.
And we have
opera. It was done quite a bit, and a radio version of it was done. And that radio version of it was one of Pre-Italia. That's the Pre-Italia piece. I think I may have mentioned that earlier.
Yes. It starts out with an operatic voice,
yes,
and then
it does.
We get a blending of styles. One, composers have something that composers of 200 years ago, a historical awareness where you can mix and match,
yep,
you know, sax horn as opposed to...
Yep. Absolutely. Cornet. That character, Carlos Arachnid, was intentionally cast as an opera tenor with a certain kind of character voice. I guess what traditionally would be called a character tenor. And and that, in a way, is part of the character of Carlos Arachnid, that he vocalizes in that style. And the other characters are cast for their... in the same way for their qualities as characters. So that's an interesting thing that you can do in, especially in a place like New York where you have all kinds of performers and singers, is to actually use the vocal qualities of the performers as part of their personality of the character they're portraying. So that's kind of interesting.
With your exploration of extended voices, you've applied them to other works.
Oh, yeah. And it's discussed in the book to quite a degree. The extended voice notion actually has been around for a while. The first well-known figure to create it was an English singer originally from South Africa, named Roy Hart. And he claims to have gotten it from his teacher, whose name was Alfred Wolfson, or Wolfson, and who was a medic during World War I and claims to have been inspired by the sounds of the wounded and the dying, which is a rather grim description of where the idea of extended voice came from. But Roy Hart took those ideas of Wolfson and really brought them to another level. Hart is probably best known or best remembered because Peter Maxwell Davies wrote eight songs of a Mad King for Roy Hart. And the vocal techniques that are in that piece were directly taken from Roy Hart, who also inspired other people, by the way, including Hans van Hense, Stockhausen, and others. Hart actually stopped doing new music after a while, formed his own group in the south of France, of all places, and his disciples actually are still around and teaching some of his techniques. However, we have a whole development of performance artists using extended voice technique in various ways. There are a number of them around today, some of them doing their own work, creating their own pieces, others working with composers and performing. I've had the good luck to write for several of those performers. We heard a little bit of Theo Blackman, though not really in his extended voice mode, in the Dutch Schultz piece. A couple other performers that I've worked with, one is Rindy Eckert, whose name has come up before. Another one is Kristen Nordeval. I wrote a piece based on the traditional myth of Cassandra for Kristen. Cassandra was, of course, the prophetess who foresaw her own death. She was taken as a captive and a prize of war by Agamemnon in the Trojan War. And she foresaw that when she went back to Greece with Agamemnon, that they would both be killed. But she was cursed because no one would believe her prophecies. Anyway, this is a modern version of the story, not necessarily sticking straight to the Greek version of it. The text is by my daughter, who is a poet and librettist named Eva Salzman, and who wrote this for me and for Kristen. It was premiered in Norway. Kristen is she's Norwegian-American, actually, spends part of the year in Norway, and it's been performed quite a bit in Europe. So anyway, we'll listen to at least a portion of My Cassandra, text by Eva Salzman, music by Eric Salzman, that's me, and performed by Kristen Nordeval.
Everything I say is true. Nice spot, sure heart. Not that I'm complaining. No, the sun. Doesn't everyone invariably vast gold?
More and more,
nice spot.
wouldn't you? A man like him commands each landing on it. A man like him owns cottages with galaxies as rooms. A man like him presides at Mount Olympus Senates. The noble elevated chambers where few women sit. He was hot and I was not. Everything I offered him. I mean that literally, what you're going to say. Well, I know what I'm going to say. Priestess by that little prick. Do I sound vain? Does this sound sick? Bring on floods destroy the crops. I've done with earthly props. You see, I say the things that no one wants to say.
Eric Salzman's Cassandra.
Text by Eva Salzman. And the performer is Kristen Nordeval. And I should mention that she creates almost all her own accompaniments with a computer using the Max program from Earcom. And, of course, there's also the sound of the helicopter, which... and the sounds of the cicadas, which we recorded. But outside of that, everything is created by her own voice and then manipulated through the computer. So, and she also, of course, accompanies herself on the piano.
You're listening to Eric Salzman, composer, author, Renaissance man, in my opinion. We're talking about new music theater, opera, here on Through the Opera Glass. I'm Mark Leosa, and he's going to be speaking on a panel about contemporary opera.
Well, this is a panel that's been organized by the Center for Contemporary Opera and the Cell Theater in Chelsea. And it's a panel or a colloquium which will discuss, take as its departure point, the New Music Theater book that I wrote with Tomas Dacey. And Tomas will be there, I'll be there, and we have a really good panel, including Rindy Eckert and Stephen Osgood, Diane Wandesford from Music Theater Group, Greta Holby, the director and founder of American Opera Projects, and maybe also Meredith Monk. I'm hoping she's going to come as well. So we'll be talking about that. It's on December 10th. It's at 8 p.m. And the cell is at 338 West 23rd Street. And the admission is free, so the public is welcome. And, well, so you're all invited.
And the website for the Center for Contemporary Opera is www.conopera.org. One word, conopera.org.
By the way, I'll just give my own website, which is fairly new. I finally got it up after all these years. And it's very simple. It's Eric Salzman, one word. That's ericsalzman.com. And that'll get you there. And there should be something on this, more information on that colloquium and on the book. In fact, the introduction to the book is on the website, so you can read that as well.
Very good. How does computer technology inform your compositional style?
Well, that's a good question. When I was at Columbia and then Princeton afterwards, was in the very beginnings of the tape and electronic music period. And a lot of the experiments were going on at that time. And then later I had a chance to work at the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Studio on a number of projects that I did. So I was always – there always was that influence in the background. Now, of course, that electronic music studio was pre-computer days, really, although the Princeton portion of that was an early kind of version of an early version of what we now think of as a computer music. The switch to digital technology, of course, was a very, very big one, and has influenced a lot of developments in new music, and it also is an important part of the development of new music theater as well, and it's discussed to some degree in the book. I think the influence is there. I think it's important. I think it's influenced all of us. I think that even the classical music field is influenced by recording technology as well as digital technology in general. My own personal opinion is that computer technology is so widespread today and is so much part of our lives that in a sense it's become less of a focus than it was before. I think it's more interesting now to understand what you can do with it rather than to celebrate the technology for itself. And again, I think that's a lesson that you get from working in the theater. And I guess that's part of why I like working in the theater, even when I'm working on operatic-type projects. In the context of the theater, there's always, what is this for? Why does this work? How does this reach out? How does this contribute to what you're trying to say? And I think musical technology has been around since somebody picked up a piece of bone and made a couple of holes in it and turned it into a flute, which is technology after all. It's not computers, but that's the same. In 2001, somebody throws a caveman throws a bone up in the air and it comes down as a spaceship. And that was what Kubrick was saying. Well, I'm saying more or less the same thing.
And a bit of trivia. He did keep the dummy music in the film and chucked the commissioned score?
That's absolutely correct.
Who was the original composer?
I think it was Alex North.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Right.
I know that when I was in California many years ago, somewhere in some museum or university library, there was an exhibition, and they had the score for 2001 that was not used. Somebody should dig it out and try and record it and see what we think of that score.
Surprise,
today.
Naxos hasn't gotten the rights to it.
I think it was – my memory is that it was Alex North and that – the whole score exists. Kubrick did what a lot of film directors do, which is that he used a dummy score, and he cut the film to the dummy score.
Explain what a dummy score is.
Dummy score is, well, when a director decides to use music as the basis for the rhythm of the film, they will lay in music, an existing recording, and then they will cut the film in a way that corresponds to the dummy score they're using. But then that forces the composer eventually to follow the structure of the dummy score in writing a new score. Uh-huh. And I guess Alex North didn't succeed in doing that, or at least not to Kubrick's idea, because he preferred his dummy score to the original score that was written for the piece, and he ended up using the dummy score. That's exactly correct.
Well, Kubrick had a very vast musical understanding and taste.
He did, and as a matter of fact, probably was the single person most responsible for Ligeti's fame because of that film. He really made Ligeti into a world-famous composer by using his music in that score, and not that Ligeti didn't deserve it, and not that he might not have gained a similar recognition on his own, but that certainly helped Ligeti become one of the world's best-known composers.
I'm going to ask you to speculate. In your book, you mentioned stage directors becoming auteurs of not writing music, but of assembling all these disparate groups.
Right.
If he was still alive, do you think Kubrick would have been a master of this?
Boy, I would sure love to have invited him to do something. That would have been a great coup. Of course, we have had some examples of film directors getting involved in opera and music theater, notably Altman, who was involved with the two Bill Balcom, Arnold Weinstein projects, at least two, wasn't it? View from the Bridge and A Wedding. Mm-hmm. I think he was involved with both of those. Now, who did the – also, what's his name? The English director.
Sellers?
English director with an Italian name who did the Madame Butterfly at the Met, was a film director.
Zeffirelli?
Minghella?
Minghella.
Yeah. And so there you have more and more examples of film directors. Incidentally, apropos of this, I'm involved in a project to do a production of a very unusual piece by the American composer Morton Feldman with a text by Samuel Beckett, a text that was given to Feldman by Beckett. And the piece is called Neither. I don't know which way you want to pronounce it. But anyway, we're going to do a workshop of it with the Center for Contemporary Opera in the spring at the Cell Theater, the same place that the colloquium on my book will be. But this will be later in the spring. I think it's in May. And the singer, it's a piece for one soprano, and the soprano will be Kristin Nordahl, who we just heard doing my Cassandra. And we're also thinking about asking a young film director. Maybe I shouldn't say his name, but because it's not signed, sealed, and delivered.
Oh,
but
well.
Probably will be. So the connection between film and music theater and opera is very real, and it's discussed in the book a little bit. There are some critics who feel that film took the place of opera as being the sort of Gesamtkunstwerk, the apex work form in the arts. The opera was in the 19th century, and then film became that form in the 20th century. Now, of course, music doesn't always play such a big role in film, but it plays a pretty big role, sometimes unacknowledged, certainly since sound film has come in. So there's an interesting connection. And we also notice more and more that new operas, which used to be based on novels and plays, then more and more we see examples of new operas based on films.
The works of Claude von Italy, the multimedia artist.
Sure.
Would you consider that opera? Because there's music elements, there's video elements, dance, improv. How does that fall into music theater?
It's an interesting question. In the 60s and into the 70s, new experimental forms of theater were evolved, and Jean-Claude Van Italy was definitely part of that movement, but he wasn't the only one.
Right.
there was a strong tendency for new theater to take the form of music theater. A famous example of that is the André Serban, Elizabeth Swados Greek trilogy, which was done at La Mama and then revived a couple of times since, where music played a very, very major role. But there are lots of other examples. A lot of productions at the Avignon Festival in France, which is a festival basically of avant-garde theater, but many, many of the works involved in that festival were works that we would think of more as music theater than anything else. And those were incidentally works which often the director was a key figure more than even the composer, putting together a team of writers, actors, dancers, choreographers, visual artists, composers, performers, whatever. There was a tremendous tendency in that direction, and it's a tendency which still exists in experimental theater today. So it's a good question. One of the things that came out of that experience of that type of music theater was what we call performance art, which also often, not always, often has a very musical aspect to it. We see that with performers like Diamanda Galas or Laurie Anderson and others.
From your experience and practice, do you see creators more aware of the audience and maybe the financial constraints that, oh, we have to make this commercially viable and not just writing for themselves?
Well, the issue of commercially viable is always a tough one. The issue of audience is easier to answer because, yes, I think you can't really be in the theater without thinking about the communication with with an audience, and that audience is part of the equation. And I think that's significant. And I think the truth is that you really don't have an abstract theater. It's not really a viable concept. There's never really been – it's been tried, but never with much success. In the sense that you have abstract painting or you have abstract musical works in this in an instrumental serialist vein, for example, you just don't. I mentioned in the book a moderately famous work by a German composer named Boris Blocher called Abstract Opera No. 1. And I thought that was really interesting, but I want to know, where's Abstract Opera No. 2? Apparently, it never got to that one.
Really?
I think it's hard, even in opera, but certainly in theater, to think about abstraction. And I think there's always inherent in theater the idea of the door that's open to the street. And to me, that's significant. That's why at the end of a work, fairly abstract work like Cassandra, which we heard earlier, you have she sings what is in effect a song. She accompanies herself and sings a song, and it's like a terrible moment for a song because this is a woman who's about to die, and there's something I find very touching and very relevant about the idea that at the last moment in this situation, as she sees her own death, and Cassandra is a prophetess, she can see it, and she chooses that moment to sing a song. And even at a moment when the text is, in a sense, closest to the Greek original, she's actually quoting from the Greek original at that point. So it's that conjunction of disparate elements, again, the cognitive dissonance, which I think makes the point. And part of that is because the door is open to the street.
We're talking with Eric Salzman, co-author with Thomas Dacey, of the New Music Theater, Seeing the Voice, Hearing the Body, published by Oxford University Press. And in his book, he mentions the art form that never happened, but he doesn't say who the composer was or the work. Perhaps he will reveal it at the contemporary art.
That's really Thomas's story, and I never pushed him.
Okay.
It's a story that we tell in the book about somebody who tried to create this great work and this great art form. And it's a very amusing story, but I'll have to, I think the best thing is to refer you to the book and the story as it's told in the book. We try to organize the book in a slightly unconventional way, putting in little interludes or intermezzi or whatever you want to call it, where we tell stories really about the performance experience that both of us had dealing with new work and so on.
How much of an influence did the American government have after World War II? Darmstadt, reorganization of the radio network and later TV network?
That's interesting, and it is discussed in the book, and it's not very well known. But Darmstadt was set up actually by an American composer who was in the U.S. Army and was part of the occupation forces and had responsibility for cultural things. And he managed to get the money to set up the Darmstadt summer courses and festival. His name was Everett Helm. He was also a composer and a critic. He wrote for the Times, reported from Europe quite often. And it is very amusing that that avant-garde European music had this great center in Darmstadt, which almost nobody knows was actually funded by money from the U.S. as part of its post-war efforts on the theory that supporting cultural development in Germany was an important part of the rehabilitation of Europe after World War II.